Hospitalitychain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, Hospitalitychain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace. Today's podcast is sponsored by Invacus. Invacus provides vacuum packaging solutions for food service and packaging professionals. Their brands include Hinkleman vacuum sealers and Greenback multi-purpose pans. This equipment can help operators save time and money and allows kitchen teams to be more efficient in their day-to-day operations. I know from my experience, I've used the pans for a lot of marinating, time-saving, cooking. Having a 10-gauge mill steel really makes the most versatile pans with the Greenbacks. If you want to check more out, go to Invacus.com. That's Invacus.com. Welcome to episode 2 of the Fell Into Food podcast. I am your host, Jeff Fell, aka Chef Jeff. We're in the beautiful, gorgeous IDM content kitchen to record. And with me today is a Chicagoland native with a passion for food and related systems. He has spent over 3 decades in the industry, ranging from a professional chef, consultant, salesperson, and many more roles. Welcome, regional sales director and corporate chef for Irinox, Mr. Chef Michael Marsh. Welcome.
Hello, hello. Thank you for having me.
Yeah,
glad to be here.
Super excited to get into some blast chilling and specifics, but we're not going to go right there first. But I really want to get into it because when you were teaching me on some basics, I kind of, my mind was blown with where it's gone and even what my perception was. So before we get there though, I want to know a little bit. I always ask and want to know kind of the baseline journey of how someone got into food. You know, seeing kind of your bio, you seem to be more of a natural kind of just fell into it, you know, whereas some others, it kind of, it doesn't come that, like me, it's just all of a sudden it kind of came and I jumped into it. So why don't you give me a little bit of context of kind of how you got into this crazy industry.
Yeah, I would definitely, I guess how you described it, natural. I mean, I have a ton of friends who I think we can all name, like a former doctor who now cooks or, you know, whatever. I know an MIT grad who is now a chef, you know, and we come in different ways. But yeah, mine's always just been food, like since I can remember. So, you know, just growing up, I had an uncle who at the time was a pretty well-known chef in his own right. I guess this is, I think, 70s, early 80s in Chicago. And he, you know, he was having some success in getting recipes into the newspaper at the time. You know, that was the thing. We didn't have all the technology we have now. So I remember that pretty vividly, and just when he was around, because he was a chef, so shockingly we didn't see him very often, but he lived in the city. But yeah, the big thing for me was, you know, I was always in front of the TV watching, you know, as much food or cooking content as I could that was available at the time.
That's when, so it was pretty good, much, though. That's,
yeah, like that PBS, was the... yeah, Julia Child, the Burt Wolfs, the Frugal Gourmets, the you know, Nick Stellino. Whatever was on, you know, because you didn't have a choice at that time. You consumed what was available. It's not like today. So that's kind of, that inspired me. And then I had, you know, my grandmother would even like record shows while I was at school. Something cool was going to be on. And so I'd watch them later on VHS. And then, you know, if it inspired me, I'd, you know, talk my parents into, you know, buying, sourcing the ingredients so that I could, you know, do a really bad job of, you know, duplicating whatever it is I thought I was going to make. But it wasn't great, you know, because I think I was like 10, 12 years old, you know, doing this stuff. So
practice makes perfect. Yeah. You get that out of the way early, in the early years.
Yeah. So I had the bug early and I just kind of assumed from the get go that that I think was going to be my future. So I started my first job at 14. I was in a small little kitchen in little old Oswego. That was my first job washing dishes, and then just kind of kept going from there. So
that's awesome. And yeah, you've done all sorts of stuff, right? You've been in the actual restaurants.
Yeah, I've worked, I mean, independents to corporate stuff to consulting. I did a brief stint. I didn't know, I mean, I probably still don't know what it is I want to do eventually, but I'm just kind of always seeking. But, you know, I had, when I was working in the city, I did a couple like stage jobs with some larger catering companies. Cause like, oh, maybe I want to be in catering. Cause you know, I just wanted to see what the other side was like, but the mass catering thing, that's chaotic too.
It's a beast. It's like the ideation and catering is great. Yeah. But when it comes to execution, it's like, all right, now do that 2,000 times. It's right. Like, oh no.
Well, then it's offsite. So it was like
the logistics. And
we're talking like 1996, 97.
You don't have the stuff you got today with cold storage and
40-gallon pot of soup over like 8 sternos that are with a wire milk crate.
Yeah,
like, that's things the way like to do that. It was a little wicked. So I tried that a couple times, but yeah, really. You know, I bounced all over the suburbs in high school and early on, right out of high school. Went to JJC. JJC alum. In the house. Yeah. I'm an alum, not a grad, but a proud dropout, let's say. Left JJC simply because at the time I was working for a couple really talented chefs, and I was learning what I felt was more than I was
the same way, right? I think it was my last semester I was so close to dropping out because I was like, I am learning so much more in the real world than I am, like, don't get me wrong, I learned some great basics, I learned some good techniques that I still use today, but I was like, the practicality of working fast in a tiny space constantly on the go, I was like, I was working two jobs, I was like, and school, I was like, just drop. And then I don't know, I was just like, you literally have like 3 months, just 3 months. I stuck it through. I bombed every like physical written test because I was like, I don't want to learn. I think, I don't know if I had to do French or what language of cooking, like that was part of it. Like you had to learn like the terminology. So I bombed every of those tests. The only thing that saved me was my cooking ability. Like I could ace every cooking exam, everything that had to do with the food. So I think I ended up passing with like an 89 or 90 because I literally got like a zero on, cause I just, I'm like, I don't have time for this.
Yeah. So, I remember, you know, on the job learning is amazing because you immediately get to implement what you just learned. Whereas I felt at school, it was like, okay, I just learned this, but when do I get to do it? So
yeah, we both had the same chef at Joliet Junior College.
Yeah.
We had Keith Vonhoff, right?
Yeah. He was there. He was there when I was there. I mean, they've made some changes over the years. I know it's, you know, we're probably a few years apart there, but yeah. So I just basically said, all right, I'm going to, you know, unenroll and re-enroll in the School of Hard Knocks. And so shortly after that, one of my chefs was leaving the restaurant, and so he took me with him, and we went to the Palmer House at the time. They were opening a new restaurant. So he brought me in for that project, and that's kind of where I was for almost 5 years till I went back out to the burbs. So again, working for independent, you know, two-unit operation steakhouse, you know, so.
Yeah, so we fast forward, right? And then all of a sudden you start finding, you know, some of these corporate type positions, right? And so now I'll lead you know where you're in Earnock. So, like, how did you get introduced? How was that, you know, because, again, I've talked when I had Chef Alvaro on, it's kind of like some of these companies, these corporate chefs, like, it's kind of the coveted spot gig nowadays of like, wow, I get to work for a manufacturer or a food manufacturer because you're not in the grind, the same grind. It's always a grind in our industry, but it's not the same grind of like, all right, I got to be at the kitchen at 4 a.m., get things opened up, make sure things go. So how did you get introduced to Earnock's, or how did you work your way eventually into the position you're at today?
Right, yeah. That was actually a longer journey than I had anticipated. But yeah, I had been working the steakhouse for like a dozen years. Like I hadn't realized it. And I just woke up one morning and I was like, holy cow, been here a while now. I need to maybe start looking for the next thing. So I knew that there's numerous corporate chef jobs out there. I mean, you could be very heavy on like food design, menu design side or ingredient side. But then there's a whole nother side of like the companies that manufacture all this cool technology that we use in restaurants. At the time, my brother was working for a company like that out of Texas. And so I was bothering him about, you know, the chef team down there and what was going on. But that was not an option for me. Again, these spots are kind of coveted, so they don't open up.
They're dime a dozen, yeah.
They don't open up all the time. So, but then he joined the team at Rationale, which is, I mean, a piece of equipment I love. And unbeknownst to him, another person that worked there knew who I was, and we had a conversation, and I was brought on as like a subcontractor to do training, support, and demonstrations and other support activities on the food culinary side. Mm-hmm. So it was through that activity over, I did it for about 10 years all in, but at that same time, I was then introduced to Irinox because that was a critical piece of equipment we were also using in the kitchen just to facilitate, you know, quick chilling and freezing. Mm-hmm. So I had an introduction to Irinox, and a friend of mine that we had worked together previously also had joined Irinox already. So we had kind of a year-long kind of discussion about, you know, getting me a position and kind of defining a position for the Midwest, basically, because the center of the country hadn't kind of been represented yet.
Yeah, it's always the coast, right? They always hit the coast hard, and then the Midwest.
Yeah, I mean, that's like where the bulk of the revenues are, at least initially. If you're a smaller company, that's where the potential is, the coasts, because of the populations. So
then what differentiates what you do from, you know, quote unquote, regular chef, right? Your day-to-day type activities. Because again, when we talk about these things and everyone's like, oh, you're a chef, it's like, oh, so you must cook all day and you run a kitchen and a restaurant. It's
what's
like,
your favorite thing to cook?
Exactly. They always and say it's that, like, yeah. No, actually it's different. So what differentiates what you do versus your typical everyday chef?
Yeah. I mean, There's still a food, you know, focus to the job, but now, you know, I'm also in charge of sales. But what makes a lot of good manufacturers different is that they just focus on, you know, solving the problem for the customer. And so when you have a vast background in kitchens already, it's very easy to, you know, walk into someone's operation, identify some issues, ask the right questions, and then provide an equipment solution in that case. But part of that journey, though, might be getting them into a kitchen, cooking some similar products to what they might be using in their operation, or even having them bring their products. And we can work specifically with that product and then get them to a desired result based on, you know, what they're looking to do in the operation. Is this about the blast chilling? Is this about the freezing? What is your product? And then we look at having that chef knowledge. You know, there's just certain things that are known. You know, you need to know about fats and moisture and, you know, just like in cooking, we know cook times and how things cook. We kind of take that approach on the chilling side too, to help them achieve the best results. So that's where the food background comes in, is and in the operations, is saying, hey, I see you're doing that, but with this piece of equipment, you can now do this, and you can do more of, you can probably make more of that, and, you know, streamline your process while also improving the product in a lot of cases.
Yeah, well, because blast chillers, right? So we're going to dig into it, because I find them fascinating, because it's always the I don't know what the word I'm looking for is. It's almost like the icing on the cake. It's like the want of the kitchen, right? It's like, oh, you have to have an oven. You have to have, well, you know, maybe a stovetop. But then when it comes to like these other pieces, it's like, oh, we should get a blast chiller. It's always like, well, like we'll ice wand it and we'll do this or that. And then when you get to actually use one, and the time savings and everything that goes into it, food safety alone, right? I mean, when you really think about food safety, how many people are just putting in ice wands that who knows if they're clean? They're trying to put crap into hotel pans and put in the freezer or whatever, and then ends up freezing and it's probably not cooling down properly. Like, it has a place, and I just don't think enough people utilize the technology today like they should.
Yeah, I mean, it's a valid point. I equate it to, I mean, it's like a lot of new technologies. There's an education process, right? Blast chilling's not new. The concept's not new. But the focus on it definitely has intensified, I would say, definitely over the last 10 years, but probably specifically in the last 3 or 4 years, just because during COVID, we saw almost like a knee-jerk reaction to, like, you know, refocus on food safety, which is, I mean, as chefs is kind of funny because it's always been about food safety. But for some reason, the industry was like uber freaked out about food safety because all the germs and everything. So chilling now becomes, I think it's at the forefront. Like, people have answered a lot of the other questions in the kitchen, which historically have always been around, how do I store food? How do I cook food? Like, those are always
the baseline,
the baseline questions. And there are a million solutions for all of that. What's next? Now we've got a cook chill system. We need to package that product, obviously. So that's where the Henkelmann would come in. But yeah, where does the blast chiller get applied? Because a lot of people understand the food safety part, but not all the other benefits that come with it.
Well, so. I mean, yeah, because what? I mean, I know maybe it's changed, but I don't think so. Is like the number one way people get sick is improper cooling or heating of food, right? Yeah. That's where the bacteria grows. And if it's not out of that temperature danger zone and you get sick, people think it's because it's the restaurant's doing something. It's 9 times out of 10, it's the heating or cooling process because it's not done the correct, safe way.
Yeah, by far.
But you're not, I mean, like, so Earnox, right? I mean, it's... especially this, the MultiFresh Next, right? The next iteration and the capabilities. What sets it apart, right? There's always pieces of equipment in the market. It's like, what sets them apart from the competition, right? Because there's, I mean, again, it's just like a refrigerator or an oven. It's like, there's 100 of them out there, but it's like, why Earnox?
Right. Yeah, there are a number of blast chiller companies out there. What separates us, probably two or three key points. One is the manufacturing of the product. It's a very well-built, heavily engineered product. We spend a lot of time listening to feedback from our end users and past users. So whenever we do relaunch or redesign a product, it's now being rolled out with usually more features, more applications, solving more problems for the customer. But the key, I think, two keys there, chilling performance. There's just certain things our units are engineered to do that, comparable equipment can't perform because they're probably just under-engineered, either for cost purposes or other. We make a promise to each end user that each unit we build is going to do a certain task. So we have to make sure we back that promise up. So the quick chilling, as we've talked before, 90 minutes or less hot to cold on chilling, 4 hours or less hot to frozen. These are part of the guarantees we make to the end user. So we got to make sure it can do that. So there's certain things in regards to compressors and coolant flow, the type of coolant, the fans, all of these things combined lead to, this high performance piece of equipment that, by the way, has a bunch of other functionality as well besides chilling and freezing.
Yeah, I want to get into that because when I learned that it has cooking capabilities now, I think my mind kind of went... I was like, that can't be, that there's no way that machine or a piece of equipment that blast chills also can now cook. So like I've never seen that anywhere, right? It's like almost an all-in-one outside of like roasting and stuff like that. Like you can get a lot. Like we played around with some pork and I put that bad boy in for 18 hours. And I was just, it blew my mind. And then being able to set it and program it, like if I wanted it to chill down, I can have that set. I don't even have to touch it. I literally can load it. And then when I come in, it's going to be cooked and chilled and ready for service. So like talk about that function of the unit.
Well, and that kind of brings it full circle. The one point I was going to make too is totally unique, at least in the chilling sector, is our company provides chefs like myself, and we use contract chefs as well and other corporate chefs. We provide these experts to kind of explain, what I'm about to dip into. And that's where that chef background really comes in handy too, because we're not just cooling stuff. So MultiFresh Next has chilling, has freezing, but it has an operational range of -31 on the cold side. So very efficient in chilling and freezing, but also it could go +185 on the hot side. So same cabinet, that temperature range. So now the possibilities, I wouldn't say are endless, but are multiplied several times. So every MultiFresh Next unit that we manufacture comes standard with a core group of programs that can allow you to chill, freeze, retherm, thaw product, proof product, low temperature cook, low temperature cook chill, low temperature cook freeze, or low temperature cook and hold, pasteurization, and a multitude of other functionality. And then it can be configured, you know, sector specific. So, you know, we usually ship a unit with access to most of the programs, but if you want to configure your unit because you're a bakery, we can activate that setting so that you're not seeing the, you know, steamed vegetables setting or whatever. So it can be customized to the end user's spec, fully programmable. We can create as many programs as we feel need to be on there. So this becomes really useful for larger operations or folks managing several units. So we can almost remotely via the app, we can send programs and things like that. So it's a takes us well outside the parameters,
the norm of what you can do.
A blast chiller.
Yeah, because you can basic to a degree sous vide, right? I mean, if you vacuum sealed and threw in, if you're low cooking at 130, right, and you want that, I mean, essentially, if you really wanted to a degree, right?
Yeah, we're just using, you know, cabinet temperature instead of water as the medium. So what that allows you to do is your food could be sealed, but it doesn't have to be. It could just be in a tray or a pan. It could be submerged in oil if you want to just oil poach something. So it gives you a lot more versatility without the hassle of the water. I'm sure you've sous vide plenty of things. If we're not being super scientific about it, we know 90% of all products don't care 1 degree, you know, or the other. So great as a sous vide machine. And then the bonus is if I want to do something 7, 8, 10 hours overnight, but I need it cold, it can automatically move into the chill for you. So that's one more step we don't manage.
Right. You could essentially do a bunch of steaks or do whatever the product is and then chill it and then it's ready to go.
Yeah. You just walk in and if it's bagged, you're just moving bags into the cooler. Yeah. Now, so
that's super cool. I know that we played around and I did a test with pasta because I was like, that was always my biggest pain in larger college operations was how, you know, we're cooking 200 pounds of pasta at a, and it's dump a bunch of ice, try and get it chilled down. You got to find that right, you know, al dente. It's even pre-al dente because by the time you can get 200 pounds in a tilt skillet chilled down and then you're trying to drain it with water, it was a giant pain. And we did it, but so we played it out and I figured out how to do it in the machine, end up covering it and put the probe in it. And I was like, this could be a game changer if you're cooking large amounts of dry pasta. It was a really cool experiment. I had to do a couple of things to try and figure it out, but it was cool.
Yeah, I think, I mean, volume in general becomes a lot easier, and that's what people, you know, I think they miss that part when they think they're getting a blast chiller. While chilling is actually the pinch point in a if we're doing a proper cook chill system. It may take you 15 minutes to cook the chicken breast. It might take you 20 to 25 to 30, depending on the piece of equipment you have, to chill that chicken breast. So it's always a pinch point. That being said, it might take 50 minutes to 120 minutes to 200 minutes in your refrigerator. So you're still speeding your process up exponentially. So when people finally understand this, they're like, oh my gosh, I can actually crank out, you know, two or three times what I used to do because, you know, the speed on the chilling side.
Well, that, you know? Again, we go back to safety. When you talk about, all right, I'm going to take a bunch of food, that soup, whatever it is, it's 190, 200 degrees, and we just rolled into a freezer or cooler. We're now adding moisture into that environment that you don't want. You're bringing down the temperature, raising the temperature of that unit. You know, I've had people, they just roll in massive amounts and then all of a sudden they're like, my cooler's at 45. And it's not designed to cool down that much product and run that efficiently. And so then now you've got issues of your main cooler that you're messing with the condensers and everything else. And it's like, that's what it's designed. It's going to pull and do all of its scientific-y things and pull that moisture out and maintain that cabinet temperature.
Yeah, most refrigeration systems are designed to like maintain temperature, whether it's a freezer or a fridge, a reach-in, a walk-in. But I see that all the time. I walk into operations where the team's rolling, you know, full racks full of hot food into the freezer, which is not great. Again, you're compromising the product in the freezer, but then you're also probably calling your HVAC guy fairly often. So, yeah.
Two more things on blast chilling. Can you share any common mistakes chefs make when using blast chillers and how to avoid them?
Good question. Well, I do see a lot of people wrapping food. That's one thing I always run into. I'm like, that's the opposite of what we would like to see, because just like in cooking, you know, when you're cooking food, when you wrap it, you're trying to protect it from over browning or crisping, or you're trying to seal in the moisture so that it will steam or braise. So you're insulating that product from the cabinet temperature, which we don't want. So that's something I do a lot with folks, is you're loading your food unwrapped as it came from the heat source. So it's something we talk about a lot, especially with the Irinox, is just take the food straight from the oven, the fryer, the steamer, wherever it is you cooked it, and go immediately into the blast chiller. Unwrapped is best because it will chill faster. We're using convection to speed up the chilling, but we're actually pulling air inside the cabinet. So we're not forcing air onto the product.
Yeah,
the fans are sucking the heat and moisture off the product to speed up the chill, and then that reduces the drying that you would get from all that air moving around. So
then that leads into like blast chilling trend. I don't know if that's the right word, but I use the word trends for 2024. What would you see, like blast chilling or the unit specific? It could be that whole piece. But what kind of trends do you see, if any, you know, with blast chilling?
Well, if we're talking like sectors or
well, just like applications. We're going to talk like the blast chilling, and then I want to go more into like just overall 2024 trends. But really, is there anything crazy you see? People, like you said, it's got a pasteurization, a proofing. Like, do you see like people being like pizzerias being like, wow, I need a machine to proof my dough? Or is there anything that you just have seen an uptick of potential customers or something like that that has true application?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. And bakery, pastry, I mean, that's kind of our genesis when we started in Italy 30 some years ago. You know, our target market was bakery, pastry, gelato shops. So a lot of what we've engineered was based on that, because you know, the freezing, a lot of freezing sometimes gets a bad rap, but freezing's always been there on the bakery pastry side. Like, no one's making every single piece fresh every single day right before you walk in the door. So freezing's been happening, but I would say for us, just in general, I mean, we see a lot of high production commissary type operations that are simply just trying to speed up the cook chill process, reduce the time from prep production to packaging, and so they can actually sell the product and now extend the shelf life. So call it commissaries, call it meal prep. Anyone producing mid to high volume food should be using a blast chiller. That's not always the case.
Of course not. So then if we go broader, right? In your vision, how do you foresee culinary tech evolving over the next decade? And what role is it going to play in the kitchen? This could be food, this could be equipment, this could be software, but where do you see it over the next decade?
I mean, it's already been on the move. I know, I mean, I'm not educated enough to deep dive on the AI topic, but obviously we know AI is going to, at somewhere, have a role. I think we've seen POS systems really come a million miles the last 10-15 years. I mean, they kind of just manage everything front and back of house, you know, standardized recipes and ordering and inventories and you know, dollars and cents are tracked in real time. I think that's obviously going to continue. We see a lot of, and this won't stop either. I think there's a couple technologies that used to be only for the 3-star Michelin restaurants, you know, like sous vide. That's where it got well known in the chef community. But now we see, you know, it doesn't matter what your operation's doing. You guys might be, you know, trying some sous vide products. And if you're not doing it yourself, you're probably buying sous vide products.
Yeah, I actually visited a manufacturer out in Ohio, and that's what they do is they do, I don't know what the technologies are. They're the big tumblers.
Chiller.
Yeah, I mean, the thing was from Germany. It looked like a spaceship, and they put stuff in there, and they talked about how it just pulls it. And I was like, we can't do delicates because it'll just beat it to all hell. And I was just, it blew my mind how they were doing soups and pastas.
Fast casual concepts are, especially if it's poultry, that's probably a sous vide product if it's not deep fried. So
there's just not enough labor anymore to do some of the baseline stuff that's like, oh, let's just make pasta. And it's like, well, while it may seem simple, right? It's a simple but complex, right? Do you overcook it? Is it chilled down properly? Is it gummy when you reconstitute it? And people figured out how to do it in the masses so that you can actually buy it ready to go, sous vide, do it, right? And it's now it's just warm it up and serve it, and you've got perfect product, and it gets such a bad rap. Whereas like before, probably what, 5-10 years ago, it was like, yeah, the product wasn't the best quality, but now you can't, you put them side by side, and it's like, you can take the best chef cook in the world and you cook something very similar, and you can be like, you can't even tell the difference because of the science that went behind that sous vide product or pre-made product.
Yeah. So we see that. I mean, so we see a lot of techniques that used to be only for the higher end restaurants now have, you know, kind of been fully embraced by the entire industry. But then we also see things that maybe were only, and I guess sous vide goes both ways here, but things that were only for industrial application kind of creeping their way into a little. So it'll be interesting to see, you know, just with any multi-unit operator, you know, I mean, as small as 3 or 4 stores now, like they want to build a commissary, which again just becomes a small scale manufacturing plant, right? So things like that are fascinating. I think we'll see if this, you know, freeze drying has legs. I know everyone's like trying to do, you see all these candies and stuff.
It's okay. Have you had the freeze dried candy?
I have. Yeah. My daughters, went through that phase already. So
I tried them and I was like, it wasn't what I was expecting. Cause I had no idea. And I tried Skittles and Sweet Tarts and I was just like, I don't think this is for me.
Well, I'm curious if we'll see that creep in somewhere. Maybe some of the higher end restaurants will find the right application for that. And again, with AI coming, it's going to be kind of the Wild West. But for sure, the current labor situation, I don't see easing.
Oh, no way. Yeah, for sure. All right, I want to go into the weeds. So here's some rapid fire, right? So, favorite cereal.
Oh, I'm going to go Frosted Flakes.
Frosted Flakes.
But it's a tough one. There's a bunch. But
Frosted Flakes, it's a solid. It's a solid go-to cereal. You just can't go wrong, right? You're not stuck with Corn Flakes. You get a little sugar on there. So you want to eat it. Love it. Is coconut a tree nut?
Yes.
By the FDA standards. So you consider it a tree nut?
Yeah, I mean, it grows in a tree. I don't know.
It does grow in a tree, but it's technically a fruit, right?
It's got a Durum
outside or a Dupay. It's always a debated topic, and it actually came up, and that's why I wanted to ask, because it's always like some people are like, yeah, it's a tree nut, and other people are like, no, it's not a tree nut, like an almond or a walnut.
Okay.
It's always interesting.
Like the tomato, right?
Fruit it's or a vegetable. Fruit, but it's...
By law, it's a vegetable, but it's technically a fruit.
Yeah, it's technically a fruit. It's got seeds inside of it, right? Favorite piece of kitchen equipment. Now, you can't be biased here, but over the years,
favorite piece.
And it could be, like mine is a Viper. It's a little bag opener. It's the stupidest thing in the world. Like people are like, wait, what? And I was like, it's literally a little piece of plastic that's got little like teeth in it that you can just... open a bag so you don't have to use a knife.
I mean, if I have to just go like my professional career, but also my home career, it's probably some sort of like burr mixer or hand mixer. Like I'm blending everything to make it smooth so that I can strain it then also. So whether it's gravies or soups or whatever. So that's probably
nice. All right. Most useful kitchen trick or tip that you've ever learned.
Also, there could be like 27 of these or 50.
What's number one? All right, what gets used the most?
A couple things, just because they're vivid in my mind. Okay. One is when I first started in the kitchen, your knife gets dull. There's no steel around. You find like the straight edge of a stainless steel table, the underside, and that straightens and usually even sharpens the knife. That's one I've used a lot of times in my career. Not with my knives, of course, but if they were like the house knives. Yeah. Turkey cooking. Because everyone knows you're a chef, your phone usually lights up a lot during the holidays from people you know. Hey, man, I'm cooking my turkey tomorrow. What do you think about? And then they outline their process. And then you're like, I have to disagree with you. This is... No. A lot of research over the years about best way to cook turkey. My favorite one, though, is slacking the turkey countertop for several hours, except you have an ice pack on the breast. So then when it goes into the oven, legs are room temp, breast is ice cold, and then you don't get dry breast meat when you, because everyone's, the solution is like, let's break the turkey down, let's spatchcock
it. I was going to say, that was my next question, is spatchcock or leave it, yeah. leave it as is?
So if you
is.
Want that whole presentation, that's one of my favorite things, is the turkey with the ice pack.
I've never tried that one. I'm going to have to, I mean, it makes total sense, right? Because you have the uneven cooking time. All right. What projects currently that you're involved in or any that you'd like to highlight or discuss? Anything up and coming?
Yeah, I know. And you asked that. And I, so I'm always searching for like the next thing. I don't have I was telling my wife this the other day. I'm like, I need a, I don't know if it's a hobby, but yeah, I need like a cause on the side, you know? So I don't know. I'm exploring my options right now. But yeah, you know, I occasionally attend the ACF meetings and I'm trying to get more active in that. But yeah, nothing crazy. Right now.
A podcast was born out of, I don't want to say boredom, but out of like, I need to do something like that gets my talking itch out because I sit behind a computer a lot. So I don't get to talk a whole lot. So this gives me the opportunity to just talk to people and listen. And I love it. So where can everyone listening or watching find you, see anything that you're doing, content, best places to find you?
At ChefMarsh95 on Instagram. I do a lot of just maybe food related stuff, but I'm on the road a lot. So it might be just travel related or just cool stuff I see. Anything, you know, I'm into anything creative that kind of gets the creative dopamine going. So I can't say, I mean, my interests are vast. Let's say that I like music. I like art. I love food, obviously. I think that's why a lot of chefs get into food is because they have some sort of creative compulsion. So yeah, I'm kind of all over the place. My job allows me to travel a bit. So I get to see some cool things, eat some cool things and meet, you know, cool people like yourself. Awesome. So
thank you, Chef. If you need anything blast chilling, this is the man. Like, he has all the answers. It can get pretty complex and in-depth, and even for my technical mind, kind of blew my mind when we first met. So thank you for stopping by. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you, and you too. Appreciate it.
HospitalityChain.com, the world's first online hub designed for the hospitality, culinary, and catering industry. From leading food and beverage brands to professional food service equipment, HospitalityChain.com makes sourcing simple. Search, select, buy direct, and save all in one global marketplace.